On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the news this week, a big verdict in Washington and a fork in the road on Iraq. Scooter Libby, the vice president's former chief of staff, convicted.
The fact that Mr. Libby was convicted of perjury and obstruction of justice doesn't mean that there was not an underlying crime of compromising the identity of a covert CIA officer.
General David Petraeus, the new commander in Iraq, said Americans are facing a long, multi-front battle.
Any student of history recognizes that there is no military solution to a problem like that in Iraq, to the insurgency of Iraq.
And Nancy Pelosi says the Democrats have a plan to get the troops out.
There are dates certain here for the first time in the Congress for the redeployment of our troops out of Iraq.
This hour On Point, our news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? Are we in for the long haul in Iraq? Will the Dems pull the troops out? What's your word on Libby, Walter Reed, Ann Coulter, the conservative search for a champ in 08? We've got a great panel with us this week. Joining us from Washington is Karen Tumulty. She's national political correspondent for Time magazine. She's been following the presidential candidates. Karen, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. Also with me in the studio, Linda Douglas, former chief congressional correspondent for ABC News, now a fellow at Harvard's Shorenstein Center on the Press, Politics, and Public Policy. Linda Douglas, great to see you.
Great to see you, Tom.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom, Karen, and Linda.
Karen, I hardly know how to jump in here. These are huge stories, and at the same time, they have been talked about and anticipated now for days. At the end of this week, I don't know, start with Libby. I mean, what is there to be said on the Scooter Libby trial and its ramifications now?
Well, you know, I think this is one that is going to follow this administration right through to the end of President Bush's term and into the history books. And in our cover story that just comes out, I believe, today on the newsstands, we take a look at where it really goes, which is to the role of Vice President Cheney. And we had, you know, from the first moment the jury got out, you know, saying that they had really considered Scooter Libby, while they, you know, certainly handed down a very tough verdict on him, they had really considered him a fall guy for the administration.
We heard that again and again, but there's the vice president. He doesn't seem to be going anywhere. So, you know, you say it's one for the history books, but what's the impact? How does it matter?
Well, I think that it is going to, you know, as politically speaking, is going to be a drag on the administration from here on out. It speaks to, you know, their tactics, their ideology. You know, through the course of this trial, we all got a lot to see about how this administration has worked behind the scenes. And by the way, we in the media did not exactly come out of this whole exercise looking so great either.
Yeah, so we hear, of course, former Ambassador Joe Wilson, his piece on uranium in Africa, and his wife being outed as a CIA agent was at the beginning of all this. He was talking out after the verdict, saying that Scooter Libby's conviction this week is significant, even though he was not convicted of revealing his wife's, Valerie Plame's, identity.
Valerie was a covert CIA officer. She served her country in that capacity for 20 years. But the fact that you couldn't convict on that doesn't mean that he didn't do it. Just as convicting Al Capone on tax evasion charges doesn't mean that he wasn't a mobster.
Doesn't mean he wasn't a mobster. Linda Douglas, there's Libby, and we'll come back to it. But take us to Walter Reed. There's another one that's been unfolding for weeks now. So many heads have rolled now. Secretary of the Army, as high as that. But the testimony this week was still really heart-wrenching from the families and from wounded soldiers who have had to deal with that. Is this behind the president with these high-tier firings, or still trouble for him?
I think this still lies ahead. This is going to be the new big story, which shockingly hasn't been the story all along. Every time the Veterans Administration has come up to Congress and asked for money, it has asked for too little, and it has been revealed in hearings that there were, in fact, more wounded, more injured, long-term injuries, a greater problem than we realized. And it wasn't really, sadly, until the Washington Post picked up on this and ran with it, that they've now exposed legions of problems that are just beginning to be explored now by the media. For example, there was a story story in one of the papers this morning about how the National Guard servicemen aren't getting their disability checks unless they beg for them at the same rate that the regular army is. Mm. Every media outlet now is looking at this. Finally, members are stepping up and demanding a huge overhaul. So now you have soldiers, obviously, who were sent to Iraq. There's a question about whether that was justified. Mm. And now there's going to be a massive questioning of whether we're treating them well when they come home. That will all be blamed on the Bush administration.
And this at the same time that your former colleague at ABC, Bob Woodruff, is shining a light on just simply the volume of wounded coming out here. Medical treatment way up in quality and speed, so they don't necessarily die, these young soldiers, but they may come home seriously wounded. Jack Beatty on Capitol Hill, Congress, the Democrats staring right at Iraq, and finally maybe hammering out a proposal they can rally behind this week. What do you think, Jack?
Well, yes, they have. They put together a plan that essentially would say if the Iraqis do not meet the political and military benchmarks that the president laid down in his State of the Union address and earlier by July, then the process of withdrawal will begin and begin post-haste. And in any case, the withdrawal of combat troops will be completed or should be completed by early next year or late next year, depending upon which timetable you use. It all sounds good for people who want the United States out of Iraq, but of course the president will veto the bill, and that'll set up some very tough votes. Tough votes for Republicans in purple districts will have to vote on the bill, and yay and nay on the override of the president's veto, and tough for Democrats in swing districts who have to vote to remove the troops, to set a deadline, and that could be controversial. And it also sets up the presidential election. On the one hand, we have open-ended commitment. That's what David Petraeus is really saying. Our commitment is open-ended. And that's what the Republican candidates have been saying. And the Democrats are going to say, date certain, we're out.
Here's Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, yesterday talking about the Democrats' priorities around Iraq in a news conference.
We're talking about supporting the troops with the funding they need, honoring our promises to our veterans, holding the Defense Department to the standard that they have about readiness before we send our troops in, holding the Iraqi government accountable to the benchmarks established by President Bush.
But Republicans pushing straight back. Here's House Minority Leader John Boehner of Ohio saying yesterday the GOP won't support an emergency spending bill with the Democrats' troop withdrawal provision.
Republicans are not going to vote to tie the hands of our generals and our troops underground, slowly bleed the resources away from them, and we're not going to vote for failure in Iraq, and which is exactly what their plan does.
Republican and Democrat partisan wrangling here, but also wrangling within the Democratic Party. Karen Tumulty, does it look to you as though the Democrats, Nancy Pelosi, at least in the House, have finally found a way to rally behind one position on Iraq?
Yeah, I do think so. I think she would not have put this bill out there if she weren't fairly confident that she could get the votes in the House. But I am still very, very skeptical that this will ever even reach a vote in the Senate, much less get to the president's desk, because, of course, the basic, you know, mathematical reality here has always been that to get anything controversial done in the Senate, you don't need 51 votes. You need 60 votes to get past a filibuster. And I just don't see how the Democrats get those votes.
So, Linda, where does this leave the country on Iraq? We had a vote in November when the polls were saying people are really sick of this. Democrats get a majority. President's still in the White House. War's going on. Petraeus says it may need more troops, and military's not enough.
There is enormous pressure on the Democrats right now, building pressure from their left flank, from the people who want the troops to be taken out of Iraq right now. So it's absolutely true that it appears the Democrats in the House have temporarily coalesced around a strategy, though, again, it's tied to a funding bill. So Republicans still think that they'll be able to force a compromise rather than not funding the troops.
Because the money will be there. In fact, even more money, Democrats are saying, for this and that kind of readiness.
Trying to get Republican votes because they're adding more things that will maybe bring Republicans in to vote for that bill. But the Senate is tied in knots still. They've come up with a proposal which would cause there to be a redeployment of troops by March of next year, very similar to the one that Senator Barack Obama had opposed or had proposed early on. And now there are many senators saying that they don't want to put any kind of a timetable on it. Ben Nelson of Nebraska, for example, just won. So there won't be, not only will there not be the 60 votes, there's still resistance among Democrats. That is going to make the anti-war core faction of the Democratic Party furious because, once again, they'll fail to do anything.
So tension inside the Democratic Party, of course, also among conservatives here, big conference this week. They don't know which candidate to decide on. We'll talk about that. But, Karen, where do you see this leaving the president? I mean, he's still got nearly 2 years in office, something just shy of that now, but the poll numbers very low. A lot of cards stacked up against him in this week, not to mention having to deal with Hugo Chavez and all that in Latin America. I mean, is this still a presidency that can function? Can he pull back out some kind of operative capacity here?
Well, the single theme that runs through all of these stories that we've talked about this morning is that after 6 years of being essentially, you know, resisting any idea of scrutiny or accountability by Congress, the administration is suddenly finding itself under scrutiny on all fronts. And just this morning, if you don't mind my throwing yet another story into the mix, on the front page of both the Washington Post and the New York Times, we have really extraordinary stories about the Justice Department and the fact that they have been extraordinarily sloppy with the power that was given them after 9/11 to look into people's personal records without having to go through a grand jury or a judge to do that.
The FBI's tapping records, incomplete to say the least.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, basically what is happening here is there are, you know, windows being thrown open all over the place in this administration.
Let's get some more sounds of this week. Senator Barack Obama taking some fire this week over some investments that he made. We'll talk about them. The senator here defending himself, saying that he had set up a blind trust and did not know the specific stocks in which he had invested.
I received some sort of communication that I think was a standard mailer to shareholders of one of the companies. I don't recall which. And I didn't look at the details of it, didn't know what it pertained to, but I had a sense that this was probably something that I had a position in since it was addressed to a shareholder. It's at that point that I became concerned that I might not be able to insulate myself from knowledge of my holdings, that this trust instrument wasn't working the way I wanted it to. And so it's at that point that I told my attorneys to go ahead and liquidate the stock and just go ahead and put them into mutual funds.
There's Barack Obama this week and Linda Douglas here, that famous voice now not talking about hope and unity, but hey, we're in the campaign season talking about holdings and attorneys. Is Barack in trouble? Is this the moment at which the campaign starts to tip into all the, you know, backbiting stuff? How do you see this announcement?
Well, I don't think he's in trouble yet, certainly on this. It looks as though the story here, just in a nutshell, is that he had somebody invest money for him. He thought it was a blind investment. He claims, and you have to take him at his word, certainly, that he had no idea what this person was investing his money in. It turns out that a couple of the stocks later were the subject of political action, some of which he was behind.
Some of his big donors he's suddenly investing with. I don't know if that's a crime or even ethically wrong, but it just looks funny, and here he is explaining.
Well, there wasn't a lot of pickup on the story because I think the general feeling in the press corps thus far is that he explained it pretty well, and that is, I had no idea I invested in these stocks. The minute I found out, I sold them, and he actually lost money. But it does show you that when you are the leader on the ethics front, that you do have to be Caesar's wife in a certain way, and I think that there will be a lot of examination of every financial decision he makes, every relationship with the donor he's ever had. All of that is going to be subject to more scrutiny in his case, perhaps, than others, because he's less known and because he is a leader on ethics.
Meanwhile, in Washington, Karen, you've got the Conservative Political Action Conference. Arch conservatives in town, 6,300 for a big meeting, and a lot of wringing of hands on the Republican side that they don't have a genuine, bona fide conservative, you know, of the full stripe running for president in 08.
That's right, Tom. The conservatives are still looking for Mr. Right. And they have not yet seen him because if you look at this race, the top three contenders, John McCain, Rudy Giuliani, and Mitt Romney, the former governor of Massachusetts, are all people who don't quite line up with the conservative viewpoint, either by virtue of their records or the positions they've taken. For instance, Rudy Giuliani has been pro-choice. He has been far more aggressively in favor of gay rights. John McCain has committed some, you know, one apostasy after another as far as the conservatives are concerned. And while Mitt Romney pretty well lines up with them now, when you look back at his record earlier in his career, particularly as governor of perhaps the most liberal state in the country, he was there, you know, pro-choice and had a number of other positions that, you know, just don't line up with him. Plus, on top of everything, he's a Mormon, and there is a fair amount of mistrust among the evangelical base of Mormonism. So, you know, all of this means that none of these guys quite fit the bill yet. But, you know, I think that it is still very early in the process. And, you know, had you asked the conservatives in 1980 whether they would have voted for a divorced actor, they would have said no.
I.e. Ronald Reagan. Linda, George Will saying this week, conservatives, get over it. You've got three good choices here. The perfect is the enemy of the good, conservative columnist George Will writing this week. These guys are good enough, he says.
But there certainly is at least conventional wisdom hardening that, number one, John McCain is, number one, perhaps might be too old for voters. Polls seem to indicate they're worried about his age.
What is he,
number
he's 70?
He's going to be at 70. He's now 70. He'll be the oldest person ever to be elected to a first term.
If he took office in January 08.
Exactly. And secondly, obviously, his position on the war, there was a huge number of voters, 72%, I think it was, in the latest poll in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, who expressed opposition to his position on the war. But here's an interesting development. This morning it was reported that Newt Gingrich, who hasn't entered the race yet, sat down with James Dobson and said, look, I did cheat on my wife.
This is the head of Focus on the Family and sort of the Uber guy in the Christian right these
and
days.
And Newt Gingrich, of course, the former Speaker of the House, waiting in the wings, many think, still does very well in these conservative
polls. So he had a kind of confessional session with James Dobson, you're reporting.
He did, and this seemed to be yet another step to cement his own social conservative bona fides. These candidates are all, he's not a candidate yet, these candidates are all trying to appeal in their own way to the conservative and cultural and religious conservatives, and this looked like a step by Gingrich to try to do just that, to do sort of the Jimmy Swagger confessional. I made a mistake, I sinned, and I'm sorry.
That would be a rock in the pond. Jack Beattie, how are you seeing the Republican conservative search here?
Well, they may get another candidate on Monday if Nebraska Senator Hagel comes into it. And, of course, he would be the one candidate who, if not anti-war, is anti-surge and has certainly changed the direction in Iraq toward getting out. That would at least put that position in the Republican race. But, you know, there's some real tough moments coming up for John McCain, possibly also for Giuliani, and that is the immigration bill. That is, you know, that's something that the Democrats are willing to work with President Bush. And if they go ahead and pass comprehensive immigration reform, including what the Republicans call amnesty, which John McCain has been for, that's going to be real trouble with him with that conservative base. And will Rudy Giuliani support that or not? I don't know. But that's going to be a real tough position for him, certainly for McCain, possibly for others, when that comes up. And that'll be coming along sometime soon.
Jack, talk about in the news, the federal agents are getting tough on immigration. We saw that in our backyard this week, New Bedford, Massachusetts, hundreds of illegal immigrants pulled out of a plant where they were making their manufacturing for the military. Mothers with children screaming outside, then shipped off to Texas, and who knows? I mean, this is a tough kind of crackdown. It's going to force immigration back to the fore when people see this.
It is, and it's happening all over the country. There is just simply a much more aggressive position on the part of the government because, of course, they have to, if they're going to be talking about amnesty of some kind, they have to show that they're also serious about cutting down on illegals. And so it's almost a necessity for the Bush administration to show an aggressive front there, and also right at the border. And by the way, things at the border are apparently a lot better than they were, partly because of increased border patrol, increased surveillance, and also because judges now are jailing people pending their immigration hearings. They're not just it's not just a catch and release, and that is in fact discouraging illegal immigration. The numbers are down. So the administration, in order to is really sort of going as far as it can toward the conservatives and saying, look, we're serious about this, and look how serious we are on the border and with crackdowns on employers. Let's go ahead with comprehensive reform.
So in you go, no catch and release. I want to begin to bring our listeners in. Karen Tumulty, Linda Douglas, Jack Beatty, we've got a lot of people who want to join us. Let me go to Dottie in Beverly Farms, Massachusetts. Hi, Dottie. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Everyday listener, first-time caller.
Good to have you.
I just wanted to hear what anybody thought about Ann Coulter on Fox News the other night using the F word and how it barely got any other press except for a lot of blogging online.
I think this was at the same conservative conference where she sort of went way out with a big swing at John Edwards. And,
yeah.
And in this case, F word as in very derogatory word for homosexual.
Correct.
There wasn't a lot of coverage of that. Karen Tumulty, you've been watching. I mean, I have seen fallout, newspapers, some that have dropped Ann Coulter. I saw one in Louisiana just last night, Shreveport, saying this is going too far, ad hominem, off the hook. Karen, is the press not picking up on this because, what, they can't say the word because it's just Ann Coulter again? What?
Yeah, you do sort of get the sense that Ann Coulter is starting to, she must have passed her sell-by date at some point. I think that this presented a real dilemma for reporters because, at least in the, you know, much maligned mainstream media, because to report the comment is to use the word, and it's also to elevate Ann Coulter and draw more attention to her. So I guess most of the major media outlets took the coward's way out here and waited until the other candidates reacted to that comment so then they could report on the reaction.
And, of course, they all condemned it, including Republican candidates. I mean, this was just a kind of a cheap swipe. I mean, John Edwards' sexuality is not in any question, but he's
and
a
also,
handsome
it was,
man, and it's kind of a, just a low punch.
It was just, it was appalling, and it on top of that, it wasn't funny.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really just such a bizarre comment, and so it just lit up the blogosphere, and the stories that were written about it in the newspapers and most of the pickup that it got on television were really as second-day stories, and again, once the candidates started reacting to it, all the traditional journalists were into very safe territory as far as reporting on it.
Linda, I wonder if this means, Linda, that the bizarro stuff way out there in that kind of really slimy neck of the woods is not going to be as on in this presidential campaign.
That's a very interesting question because, in fact, Ann Coulter was given a great big platform to make that statement. Here's a woman who made fun of 9/11 widows. Here's a woman who suggested that we go over to Afghanistan and convert people to kill their leaders and convert them to Christianity.
Mm, mm-hmm.
She's been saying these outrageous things for years. She was given a very big stage, a stage where the Republican candidates had been speaking.
Right, just moments before.
Exactly. So she's a legitimate voice on the conservative side. And the fact that all the candidates, the Republican candidates, condemned what she said, the fact that newspapers are dropping her now may well signal, just as you say, a curtailing of outrageous comments,
Jack,
which have been embraced previously.
A change in the wind here, Jack, or no?
Well, but on the other side, look at the reporting over the weekend about Hillary and Obama speaking in Selma.
Mm-hmm.
An indefatigable blogger at the Horse's Mouth actually compared
the
CNN's coverage on Sunday with what they did on Monday. And on Sunday, they purported the story straight. Hillary Clinton gave the speech. She said this. Candy Crowley, their political correspondent, was there. This is what Mrs. Clinton said. Here's how the audience reacted. Here's what Obama said. Well, then on Monday morning, I think I have the date right, on Monday morning,
yeah.
Matt Drudge, who's as close to the sort of netherworld, it seems to me, as you can go.
They're also front and center very often over the
right.
recent years. Yeah.
He comes out with a big thing, Hillary's fake Southern accent, and he shows a piece of tape that shows her using a Southernism, almost a sort of Negro spiritual talk, fairly appropriate in the setting, in a church, in the speech. Well, then what happens with CNN? It turns out their editor is Drudge, because CNN then changes all its commentary. The whole day is spent, oh my gosh, look at this fake accent. Candy Crowley, who on Sunday was straight about the whole thing, on Monday, oh, well, here we go. This is Hillary. Everything is too determined. So who's the editor for CNN?
In effect, if not in fact, you're saying you've got the netherworld driving news right there.
There you go.
Let's listen to a little bit of Hillary at that anniversary observance of Selma's Bloody Sunday, speaking at Selma's First Baptist Church just last weekend.
42 years ago, from this church and from Brown, brave men and women first tried to march. 2 days later, Dr. King tried again, getting as far as the bridge. Then on the third day, armed with Judge Frank Johnson's order, more than 3,000 people crossed the Pettus Bridge. And by the time they got to Montgomery, they were 25,000 strong.
I don't know. It doesn't sound so twangy to me for a woman who was Arkansas First Lady for a while in the governor's mansion. But let's listen to Obama himself. Same day, same town, Selma, at the Brown Chapel.
My very existence might not have been possible had it not been for some of the folks here today. I mentioned at the Unity Breakfast that a lot of people been asking, well, you know, your father was from Africa. Your mother, she's a white woman from Kansas. I'm not sure that you have the same experience. And I tried to explain it. You don't understand. You see, my grandfather was a cook to the British in Kenya. Grew up in a small village. And all his life, that's all he was a cook and a houseboy. And that's what they called him even when he was 60 years old. They called him a houseboy.
Chicago man sounds just as South or Southern to my ear anyway. Karen Tumulty, accents aside, we can all go
that
South.
That didn't sound like a Hawaiian accent
well,
to you, Tom?
Not exactly Jakarta either. What about these two nose-to-nose in Selma? The talk has been Obama breaking through, maybe decisively with the black vote. How do you see it?
Well, certainly that is what the polling at this point would suggest, and that has really presented a very, very difficult problem for the Clinton campaign because they very much need African-American support. And a lot of African-American leaders right now are walking what one Clinton advisor described to me as a very thin tightrope because, you know, they're very, very excited about the prospect of the first black candidate who has a genuine chance of getting elected, and yet they feel very, very loyal to the Clintons and have, you know, over decades. And so this, I think, is going to be one of the most interesting issues for Hillary Clinton to manage over the next year. And that is why I think that her attack on Obama a couple of weeks ago over comments that one of his supporters, the, you know, Hollywood producer David Geffen, had made on her was probably a mistake. You know, upping the volume against Barack Obama over something like that, you know, only reminds African-American voters how torn they're likely to be in this election.
Let's listen to just a little sound here from Forbes magazine, releasing its annual list of billionaires this week, and associate editor Louisa Krall saying two countries in particular are producing the most new billionaires.
It was a sizzling year in Asia, as well as both India and China saw huge gains. India had 14 new billionaires, China 13.
Here's a Microsoft spokesman saying the early arrival of daylight saving time could present a challenge.
This year, the extension of daylight savings time may require more than just moving your clock up. Many technologies could be affected, from mobile phones to control systems to computers and software applications.
And then getting serious in the wake of the Walter Reed scandal, former Health and Human Services Secretary Donna Shalala, who's now heading up a bipartisan commission along with Bob Dole looking into the Army's mistreatment of wounded soldiers, promises here a vigorous investigation.
We need to talk to the patients and their families. We need to look at the system that's now in place. Every generation of my family has served in the military, in the American military. I have a cousin now in Iraq. My university trains these integrated teams that save lives in Iraq and in Afghanistan. We represent lots of Americans for whom it's very personal, for every American, and we're going to do the best job we possibly can.
It sure felt personal as those stories tumbled out. Let's take a call from Joseph in Leominster, Massachusetts. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. First of all, much gratitude for you guys. You do a great job, and it's nice to have some refreshing news these days. I'm a Vietnam veteran and a disabled veteran. And over 35 years ago, I was in Vietnam, 1969 and 70. This Walter Reed scandal, and I believe the country needs to see this as the tip of the iceberg. I still know men from, you know, my era, my generation, that are still trying to get claims made on their, you know, for PTSD, for many of the disabilities that we suffered in combat.
And we're talking and 40 years, maybe.
Exactly, and we can go back even further to World War II. I know this through, you know, my travels through veteran centers and counseling and things that I've made a part to, you know, be a part of my life. So I believe for this country to judge, to a good way to judge our candidates, both the extreme right wing as well as the, you know, left wing, is to look at the record on veterans. We are so keen to send our young men and women off to combat, to sacrifice them, and everybody is, oh, pro-troops. What are we doing, though, after we've sent them on, destroyed their lives, put them into battle, into harm's way? How do we take care of them? That is an excellent measure to look at, and I believe this administration has squandered that over and over again, just billions and billions to go out and create, you know, more heartaches, you know, more grief, and yet we're not taking care of those people that serve, that everybody says that they, you know, support. And,
Joseph,
and
we hear the experience in your voice. Jack?
Yeah, we do indeed, and salute your service. You know, and the further scandal with Walter Reed, as it's come out, is that the infamous outpatient facility in question was partly operated by a private company led by a former Halliburton executive who drastically cut the staffing, presumably to increase profits. And, of course, you have to wonder—
Outsourcing, cutting by two-thirds.
Yes. Did this private company also make political contributions to politicians, possibly to the Bush campaign? And if it did, then you have another sort of essence of this presidency, privatization of public functions in return for campaign contributions.
Linda, I also wonder, though, Linda Douglas, about how this whole scandal puts the real cost of war in front of us, a cost that, as Joseph says— we've always been reluctant to look at because the cost to soldiers goes on a long time.
Well, listening to Joseph reminds me, because I'm of the Vietnam generation, how many co-workers and people that I've known over the years who live their lives with injuries, with mental issues, with health issues. One in, for every fatality in this war, 16 are wounded. There have been something like 50,000 wounded already in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Veterans Administration tries to downplay the numbers of veterans who are seeking help when they go to the VA. They're saying, well, some of it's just dental stuff. They consistently have underestimated mental problems that have been identified by health professionals. This is an enormous issue where these young people who are young now, 20 or 30 years from now, will be living as Joseph is, will be living amongst us, and we're going to be asking ourselves, are we proud of how we took care of them?
Yeah,
it's a huge political issue.
I've seen it in my own family, relatives coming back from Afghanistan, and it's not easy. Let's go to Webster City, Iowa. Larry, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to comment on the whole Scooter Libby verdict, and I think the thing that's kind of, in my mind, a little unfortunate is that the verdict in that case was not really about the core issue, which in my mind is that this administration cannot tolerate and will not tolerate dissent in any situation. I mean, it seems like you know, from global warming to Iraq to just about anything you can think of, they've gone out of their way to not only disagree with their critics but discredit and to a certain extent personally attack them. The term I coined for it was detract and distract, and that they hope that if they make enough noise about how bad the person is that did the that disagrees with them, nobody will pay attention to the fact that the person has a point.
But they had a vision, and they were trying to implement it. Is that so wrong, Larry?
Well, yeah, it is, because it's different. This is the problem in this country right now, is that there's no real pragmatism. It's all about ideologue and ideology. And if the other person disagrees with you, it isn't that they're wrong, it's that they're a bad person somehow. I've seen this in any number of cases where they've tried to, you know, the fact that Valerie Plame was the wife of Joe Wilson had nothing to do with his findings. It was an attempt to discredit him personally rather than discredit what he was saying. And that's the problem that I see with this administration, is they do not seem to appreciate, or not appreciate, but accept dissent.
Larry, we hear it. If you let me, I want to take it to Karen Tumulty. And Karen, ask you, this kind of goes to the theme of the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings on the fired U.S. attorneys this week, in a way, where they were maybe a little off the beam, and then they were out. But there we saw Arlen Specter, Republican, former chair of that committee not so long ago, suggesting that maybe Alberto Gonzalez himself is a short-timer in that role as U.S. Attorney General. Could it be that this whole kind of, Larry says, ideological approach is shifting here, that Republicans themselves are going to be tougher if they see that kind of push underway?
Yes, indeed. What Arlen Specter said to Alberto Gonzalez was, you know, one day there will be a new attorney general, maybe sooner rather than later.
Watch out.
I think, though, that you know, the administration didn't invent this kind of demonizing of your enemies. But it has, I think, over the last 15 years, really developed as an election strategy. It was all about polarization, and the way that you won elections was to really mobilize your base and get them stirred up. And how do you do that? You make them hate the other side even more. And with the 2006 elections, if you don't mind my putting a political frame on everything, what we really did appear to see, at least, was the swing voter rise up again as a political force. And I do think that from here on out, at least maybe the next cycle or two, talking to these people who don't, you know, make every political decision based on how much they hate the other side, appealing to them, reaching to them, proving to them that you can actually govern and that you have a plan for governing, you know, that may become a smart political strategy.
That would be a kind of watershed. Jack?
Yeah, and you can see, you know, the Rovian politics, the essence of it is destroy the opposition. I mean, that's what he did in Texas, spreading rumors about people. He was forever going into people's sex lives to discredit opponents. And here you see it consistently throughout this whole management of the war and of the fallout from the lies around the war. And you also see the crudeness of thinking. There's the vice president scratching on his copy of Novak's article above in his handwriting. Did his wife send him to Niger on a junket? Now think of that. Who goes to Niger on a junket? I mean, imagine, trip to the middle of what a crude thought that is, and yet there it is. That's the level of it. You know, find the malevolent personal issue and then trip the guy up with it. I mean, that's what Rovian politics is all about. And perhaps I agree with Karen. Perhaps the 2006 election, people said enough.
Oh, well, and Tom, I just want to interject here as you talk about, because you were mentioning the U.S. Attorney's case, and this is actually another example of dealing in a fairly rough way with your opponents. Remember that at least one of these U.S. attorneys says that he was pushed out because he failed to aggressively investigate a Democratic politician right before the election.
But these were all Bush appointees.
But they were being criticized for not aggressively investigating Democrats. And there was a very interesting study in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times today, in Paul Krugman's column, that showed that of 375 cases that were of corruption investigations by the U.S. attorneys, something like 67 of them were of Republicans and 298 of them were of Democrats. So the U.S. attorneys' offices have been aggressively investigating Democrats.
This is the politicizing charge manifest.
Exactly. These didn't, and they got in trouble.
Mm. Let's go to Diana in Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Diana. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm just curious about diplomacy, the fact that we have been arguing within the House and the Senate for 2 or 3 months now about any kind of details and how we could complete the surge, whether we're going forward or not with it. But it doesn't seem like we're at all addressing the fact that Bush or Condoleezza Rice or anybody in a leadership position is pretty much lacking a diplomatic attack on this. They talk about meeting Syria and Iran and a group panel, but it seems like the media, nobody seems to be addressing this, and it seems like the most crucial way that we can get out of Iraq.
But we heard General Petraeus saying this week, Linda, that there is no simple military solution to this. Everyone out there is Odierno and Petraeus saying it may take longer, it may take more troops, but they're not saying military alone will do it, which does suggest that you've got to have politics, you've got to have diplomacy. The meeting, including Iran and Syria, coming up, tomorrow?
Right. This is where Condoleezza Rice is really starting to make her mark now. She's obviously put Iraq and Iran at the same table with the United States, and Petraeus is embracing a diplomacy. He's not holding out any false hopes that there's going to be a quick military solution, even with the increase in troops, and I think that he's trying to create some more realistic expectations about that. Rice has now got us talking to North Korea. Mm. I think that there finally is belatedly in this administration some attempt to realize that they didn't move fast enough on that front, and now they're trying to catch up.
Maybe. Let's go to Augusta, Georgia, and Max. Hi, Max. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
Yes, what I was going to comment on was just on the U.S. attorneys was, you know, they all serve at the pleasure of the president, and he's free to remove them at any time for any reason and without cause, and that's been done in prior administrations and Democratic and Republican, and then a lot of times when they take office, they clean out the U.S. attorneys and appoint their own.
Yeah, certainly. There's a lot of history on that front. The one thing we learned this week, Max, I guess, was that the Patriot Act revamp at the end of 2005 allowed the president or the attorney general to do that with no oversight from either the bench or from the Senate. Is that all right by you? Do you think the president should have that free of hand? Zero oversight?
Well, when it, you know, that's one of the things that can come with the office of the presidency. I mean, there's all kind of positions in the government where they serve at his pleasure, just like all the people that directly work for him. And the judicial system is a branch, not so much a branch of his office, but he has control over it.
It's right there in the executive, no doubt. The pushback now on just how much of his unoverseen pleasure will be at work there, even from some Republicans. Let me get another call here from Milton, Massachusetts. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, hello, how are you?
Very well.
Quickly on the immigration raid in New Bedford, it reminds me sadly of Schindler's List without Schindler or the list.
Seeing all those hundreds of immigrant workers working on products for the military,
exactly.
Bundled away.
And the thing that really disturbs me is that this war profiteering is still going on. The contract with the Defense Department still exists. That this Bianco company is still
This is the company that employed them, but they were illegal, Paul. What do you say to that?
Well, that is fine. I mean, and then you address that. Perhaps you do even what Roosevelt did with the Nisei Japanese Americans who were citizens. They were all together at least. They didn't separate families, as far as I know. Born after World War II, but
yep.
But still, they took precautions not to separate nursing mothers. That's unconscionable. And that doesn't represent the United States I want to be part of. We address the problem of illegal immigrants, yes, but you don't, in this family-cultured administration, as they protest to be, you do not break up a family just because they are illegal. There's something totally immoral about that.
No doubt. Extremely moving emotional images, and they always sit right in the middle of this immigration debate, maybe never more so than in those images. This week, Karen Tumulty, is this headed back to the front burner on Capitol Hill?
Well, there are hearings scheduled, I believe, this month or next month to mark up a new immigration bill and get it moving again. But it is something that certainly has a little bit more of a shot, oddly enough, ironically enough, in a Democratic Congress than it did in a Republican Congress for the president to get the kind of comprehensive immigration reform he's wanted all along, which combines enforcement with a legalization program. But at this point, the administration has so many problems all going at one time. I really am skeptical that you're really going to see much happen on this front this year.
And yet, on many, many fronts, Americans confronting it more and more directly, seeing it, whether it's a job lost or an illegal immigrant taken away practically in chains with the kids crying behind. These are tough images to watch. Clearly, this is one that's not going to go away. Karen Templety with Time Magazine, national political correspondent there, joining us from Washington. Karen, it's always great having you with us. Thanks for joining us at the end of this week.
Thank you, Tom.
And Linda Douglas, thanks for coming over. Good to have you with us. I hope you'll come again. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It was fun.
Linda Douglas, a former chief Capitol Hill correspondent for ABC News, now at the Shorenstein Center on the Press, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard. Jack Beatty, good to have you, my friend. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.